Whether it's controversy over standardized tests or school boundaries, our local school system and its chief are very hot topics right now. This morning, we get a closer look. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Just ahead, Superintendent Nicolai Vitti takes your calls. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Speaking of education, we're going to tell you all about the Read It Forward JAX Coalition as it launches in the city, then later a preview of this month's See the Girl Summit, plus tonight's big Oktoberfest party downtown. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, whether it's proposed changes to Duval school boundaries and academic programs, or growing frustration over the state's standardized tests for students, Duval County Superintendent Nicolai Vitti isn't pulling any punches as he lays out his vision for the district. This morning, we begin the hour as the superintendent joins us here in studio and takes your calls. Nicolai Vitti, always good to see you, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Look forward to talking to you and the callers.
So much to talk about. It's 549-2937 to connect with Superintendent Vitti, 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page. Lots to get into, but first let me ask you about what we've learned this week, that the Duval County School Board has reversed itself yet again. They've decided against allowing extra time to consider changes to 17 Duval school boundaries and academic programs. These are changes you've proposed that have met with some controversy, including pushback from Congresswoman Corrine Brown, who has even threatened legal action over these proposed changes. What can you tell us about the latest move from the Duval County School Board?
Well, the school board decides the timeline for the community engagement process. And so going into this school year, the board policy was changed to make a decision to engage the community very early and try to make a decision really before winter break. And then when I proposed all of the changes, there was a recognition that we probably needed to engage the community a bit more thoroughly and over time. So the board policy was waived last month to extend a final decision until the beginning of February, end of January. Then there was a workshop where we went a bit deeper into the proposed changes, and there was a conversation about possibly extending it all the way until June, May or June, as far as a final deadline to make a decision. And last night, there was extensive debate and conversation about that, and the board policy requires a 5-board member vote to waive board policy. It was a 3-2 vote, not 5. So therefore, it stands based on the latest revision, which would be to make a final decision by February. So we have our timeline in place. We will make that timeline as far as district administrative staff is concerned. And I still believe that we have enough time to thoroughly engage the community. We have working groups, which are stakeholders that represent each of the schools that are directly affected. It'll be made up of the PTA, the School Advisory Council, parents, teachers, business members, faith-based members in the community, realtors, et cetera, that will come together, review the proposed changes. They can reject, they can modify, they can offer different suggestions. And then after that working group process, we'll have community meetings throughout the county. And then I'll consider all of that feedback, so will the board, and I'll make final recommendations for the board to vote on as it stands right now by the beginning of February, end of January.
549-2937 to connect with Superintendent Nicolai Vitti. Now, these changes, if approved, would affect thousands of students and families beginning with the next school year, everything from New Magnet or specialized schools at Andrew Jackson High, Wolfson, Ed White High, A. Philip Randolph High, and more. Lots of boundary changes. Congresswoman Corrine Brown showed up at a school board workshop and threatened to sue. She said these changes could endanger federal Title I funding. Your argument is that these changes are necessary because some of these schools in the urban core are looking at declining enrollment, that you've got to do something drastic to keep kids in the public schools, stop the drain away to private and charter schools in St. John's County. What about the Congresswoman's concerns?
Well, I think Congresswoman Brown is concerned about just change in general, and was concerned that the community engagement process was not extensive enough or would not be extensive enough. The board policy defines the community engagement process, so certainly there's a process that we have to implement in order to just simply move forward with the recommended changes. Some board members were offended that to attend a workshop unannounced to make certain comments, which some board members felt were not completely accurate. But with that said, everyone's entitled to their opinion. We respect Congresswoman Brown as a partner in public education. But perhaps as we go through this process, there might be disagreement regarding what we need to do to transform Duval County Public Schools. I think ultimately where I stand is that if you continue to do the same things, you're going to get the same results. The reality is as you mentioned, in the urban core particularly, we see a reduction in residency rates. So we have fewer people living in the urban core, moving in the urban core. So naturally, you're going to have schools that are not fully utilized. At the same time, on the periphery of the urban core, you see an increase in residency, and you see growth. And we're not building new schools. We're not building new wings. So that means the growth is being captured by charter schools. That doesn't make much business sense. And although we are focused on children and education, we also have a $1.7 billion budget. And when you look at the long-term approach to public education, if we're not capturing growth in high-growth residential areas, what does that look like for us long-term? At the same time, in the urban core, in some schools, we have more students leaving that school than actually attending that school from a boundary perspective. Nearly 50% of students across our county are using some form of choice, whether that's charter, opportunity scholarships, or leaving low-performing schools for higher-performing schools, special transfers, going to a school outside of their boundary, or going to a career academy or a magnet school. So parents want choice. Regardless of how one feels about that from a philosophical point of view, ideological point of view, parents want choice. And we have to make some decisions because ultimately, we have the oldest set of buildings in the state. And if we are going to grow in high growth areas, if we're going to build new schools that are old and outdated, we have to do something differently regarding our utilization rates and to become more competitive. So these boundary changes are about maximizing building space, allowing for long-term growth in the future, and offering a set of programs that we think parents are going to find more interesting, which leads them to stay in Duval County Public Schools or come back to Duval County Public Schools.
And if you're just tuning in right now, whether it comes to questions about Florida's standardized testing program for students, questions about your child's school, or more, Superintendent Nicolai Vitti is in studio. We'll go to your calls and questions for him. What are your questions for Vitti? 549-2937 is the number to join the show. You recently wrote a letter to teachers, principals, and district employees, a very stirring argument against new Florida standards for assessing student performance, the test known as the FSA, the test that replaced the FCAT. And you wrote, "We need an accountability and assessment system that is fair, consistent, and reliable. Florida's system has devolved into the opposite and has been ruined by political and ideological ambition and arrogance." Do we need to throw that test out?
No, not necessarily. I think the challenge is we have moved so quickly to new standards. And by the way, I am very supportive of the new standards. I know that's not a popular stance, but when you look at what children are doing through the new standards, it's exactly what I think all of us want our children to do, which is apply information, analyze information, synthesize information, write about what they're learning. But at the same time, how you measure that through a test has not been properly done in Florida. We rushed a test that was not applied well to these new standards in Florida. Basically, we took a test in Utah and applied it to Florida. Although the standards are similar, they're not exactly the same. The test was not fully aligned. We had a lot of technological problems when implementing the test. There's not a high level of alignment to the standards, to the assessment. And ultimately, when you're judging people, and that's exactly what we do through tests, we judge teachers, students, schools, oftentimes even communities, principals, we have to make sure it's done the right way. And the transition has not been done the right way. And public education in many ways has already been beaten up over the years. Public educators have been beaten up over the years. We can do better. We need to do better. But ultimately, this hasn't been done the right way. And if we don't start doing it the right way, then I do think we have to reevaluate how much emphasis we're putting on a test. I think that's a general question and a conversation we need to have as far as public education is concerned. The pendulum has gone from very little accountability and measurement to now everything is measured through a test. And I don't think when we're looking at individual children, their success, their potential, the success potential of teachers, we should look at it through only a lens of a test. So I'm hoping that this conversation leads to a broader one, which is how do we balance the use of a test to measure success or failure with other components that might be more reliable.
In today's Times Union, columnist Ron Littlepage writes, listening to Vitti, it's not a stretch to believe the system is set up to make public schools, especially those in low-income areas, fail to bolster the Republican mantra that anything the government does is bad. Do you agree with that?
Not completely. I think if you look at the Republican Party in Florida, there is a group that is truly motivated by what's best for children. They think our children can and should do better, and they feel like accountability is the way to do that. There's another group of the Republican Party that I do not believe has consistently demonstrated a strong support for public education. And that comes through funding. I mean, when you look at raising the bar of accountability, every unit of accountability or increase in accountability should come from with a unit of support. And that's through funding. We rank from 42nd to 48th in the country with pure pupil funding. But it's hard to increase the bar with little support. And when you look at the changes that have happened with the accountability system, it has disproportionately impacted low-income children and schools that predominantly serve those children in poverty. So back to your question about the Republican Party, I do believe that there are times when I question whether the Republican Party as a whole truly understands the value and purpose of public education. Oftentimes when you talk to legislators, they themselves didn't go through public education, they don't put their children through public education, or they don't necessarily see how public education has allowed people to overcome poverty and obstacles. And you sometimes see that with the approach and the accountability and the lack of funding. But I wouldn't say as a complete whole, the Republican Party is not supportive of public education. I think it's a matter of ideology. But ultimately, we're never going to move the system to a better place if we are setting up creating a system that automatically leads manufactures low performance. And that's what we're seeing. We're going to see a manufactured increase of students that are below grade level and a manufactured increase in DNF schools. That's not a function of the test. It's not a function of new standards. It's simply saying that now students have to answer X number of questions right more than they did before, which is manufacturing low performance, not necessarily a testament to performance.
Let's go now to Jackie in Avondale. Hi, Jackie. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to state my support for Dr. Vitti and the board in allowing public schools to go ahead and open up and expand into different ideas for the children in our community. I do feel that public education is under attack and that just doing the same old thing is not going to serve our children. And when we look at charter schools opening up in our community, taking our students, parents are driving them. They're moving them out of their community into another section of town to go to private and charter schools. And we should not have different standards for children. All children should have the opportunity to go to a great school. And if that means going to a magnet in another area, then so be it, because that's what our community is already doing. So please, thank you for your efforts, Dr. Vitti.
Thanks, Jackie. Let's go now to Kim in Jacksonville. Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
Yes. Also, I'm also have been considering, I guess, joining in the opt-out movement, and I was kind of wondering what Nikolai Vidi's take was on the opt-out movement as a way of, I guess, parents and teachers standing in solidarity and saying this is wrong to place such high stakes on our children.
And you're talking about the movement to refuse to participate in the testing. Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
Thank you, Kim. The opt-out Florida network she's referring to.
Well, we were one of the few districts, and I was one of the few superintendents that provided a pathway for parents to understand how to opt out. And it was controversial to do that because ultimately we are required to promote the test and to ensure that every child tests in order to ensure the accountability of performance. Ultimately, though, I do believe in a child's individual right and a parent's individual right to opt out. That is a controversial statement, but I believe in that kind of freedom. I can also understand why the opt-out movement has increased in number. I think as a parent myself with children that have disabilities, I think the testing movement has gone too far. And based on the proposals that we're seeing right now by the Florida Department of Education, manufacturing lower performance and manufacturing more children that would be considered below grade level by simply moving the metric that defines their performance leads me to be concerned. So ultimately, I'm not at a point where I believe that the solution is opting out. I am sympathetic to those parents and students that believe that in the opt-out process. I'm going to see what happens over the next couple months before believing that opting out is the solution. I'm optimistic that we'll continue to work through this. But ultimately, I think opting out has to be something that's on the table because parents' voices and student voices are not being heard right now at the state level and a bit nationally, it's not being heard. We need a better balance of accountability that's just not driven by a test.
A little more background. The Florida Association of District School Superintendents issued a blunt statement last week saying they've lost confidence in the state's system of testing. The Florida Education Association issued a similar statement. The Florida PTA has asked state lawmakers to refrain from using FSA test scores in determining school grades and evaluating teachers. Here's a tweet from the Jacks Public Education Fund. If people want to talk more about this, encourage them to attend the One by One event on October 19th. Info is at jackspef.org. Doran on the west side. Hi, Doran. You're on the air.
Good morning, Melissa. I wanted to say that I support Dr. Vidi in general. I think he's doing a superb job by bringing in energy and engaging the community and really holding schools accountable. At the same time, I have some concern with the approach to choice. I agree with the concept of choice. However, I'm concerned about the least privileged in our community who may not be able to avail themselves of the choices. I think about the families who may not have transportation or who may not have work schedules that would allow them to take their students, their children, to those other schools where they would like their kids to get a better educational opportunity. Those kids may have to get up really, really early to take a bus, and then that means they get home really late. So that would impair their learning experience. I really would love to see Duval County do something really hard, but do it well, which is make these broken schools work as opposed to shipping everybody all over the county to pursue choice.
Okay.
And maybe that's just a pipe dream.
Thanks, Doran.
But I'd love to hear what Dr. Vidi has to say.
Thank you.
Yeah, great question, and thank you for the comment. First of all, one thing that we did 2 years ago was restored magnet transportation countywide. So even for those parents who could not afford to pay for transportation, or more importantly, if their job didn't allow the flexibility to transport their child somewhere else, or they didn't have a car readily available every morning or in the afternoon, parents can still put their child on a bus, and we reestablished, restored magnet transportation countywide for our dedicated and non-dedicated magnet programs. In addition, when you talk about just your traditional feeder schools or neighborhood schools, I think, you know, in all this conversation about choice and new programming and boundary changes, we sometimes forget that we were able to raise $40 million locally to rebuild the our human capital, which is our principals and teachers, in the Rebalt Range Jackson feeder pattern. Obviously, in the urban core, historically African-American schools that have been historically struggling and lower performing. And so for the first time, we're offering $20,000 for our best teachers to stay in those schools, $17,000 for them to relocate from more higher performing suburban schools to move in those schools. All of those schools will be wireless at the end of the year. Most of them will be to a one-to-one distribution with tablets, laptops. So we are heavily investing in our traditional schools, especially in the urban core. So sometimes I find it ironic when individuals say that, well, what about our neighborhood schools? Why is the conversation only about magnet schools and choice when, in fact, it's really a two-pronged approach? It's about offering more choice and options to be competitive in a landscape of competition and choice. At the same time, ensuring that our neighborhood schools, our traditional schools, and our struggling schools have additional resources way beyond than we've ever done in Duval County Public Schools, put the best principals, best teachers in front of our most struggling students at scale, especially in a Rebalt Range Jackson feeder pattern.
Here's a comment from Mandy on our Facebook page. How can you expect parents to stay in Duval Elementary Schools when you're teaching kids to hate school? Forcing five-year-olds to sit in class for 8 hours with no recess is ridiculous. Teachers given no autonomy. They're expected to exactly follow the curriculum and schedule. Things like educational songs and holiday parties are being eliminated. It's no wonder teachers and students are leaving. I've always been a firm believer in the public system, but the last few years have shaken my belief and led me to strongly consider a charter or private school for my two children. So there's some feedback from a local parent.
So, first of all, charter schools are public schools, so you're going to see a lot of the same constraints and challenges in charter schools as far as testing is concerned. Certainly at the elementary level and the primary level, there's been more of a focus on academics because of the change in the standards. Teachers are hard-pressed to try to teach all the math, science, reading curriculum as possible. I am always and always have been a firm advocate for physical education. We funded a full-time physical education teacher in each elementary school 2 years ago. That was not the case before. I have three boys. I very much know that they need to get out and play. We do have a certain set schedule, which includes resource. At the same time, I've given schools the flexibility and teachers the flexibility. And saying this on the air so everyone hears it, all you parents, if a teacher believes that it's time to take the kids outside because they need to run around and expend that energy, they have the flexibility to do that. Certainly a teacher in kindergarten, first grade, second grade knows when there needs to be release of energy. And when they feel like that is that time is necessary and when it's appropriate, they have the discretion and flexibility to do that. Many school advisory councils have revised the schedule based on the district's recommendation to expand resource or recess. So please do that at your school. We want parents to feel comfortable with the schedule at the same time knowing that teachers are hard-pressed to teach all the content related to the new standards.
And getting back to those standards and the FSA, what's the next move for the state's Association of Superintendents as we await the release of the test results and the state's response to all of this pushback about the test?
Well, it starts with the proposal to release school grades based on 14-15 performance without learning gains. School grades more than half of school grades have always been linked to growth. And growth is important because we know many of our children don't enter a certain grade level at grade level, yet our teachers do a Herculean job in moving them forward and advancing sometimes even up to two grade levels, but still not at that grade level. So not to recognize growth contradicts the spirit of public education and the challenge that is incorporated with teaching all children. We have been very firm as superintendents to say issuing school grades without growth is something that we cannot accept. So where the department goes from there, we will see. We are urging to fully release the performance so that everyone can see where we stand, but do not tie it to a letter grade until you're able to provide growth. And that means you have to have an apples-to-apples comparison. And that cannot happen based on 14-15 data. I also think that the public needs to understand that when you look at the data, you can do an apples-to-apples comparison among schools and among districts. But I think it's always important for people to understand that Duval County Public Schools is not St. John's County. It's not Clay County. It's not Nassau County. We have the same expectations for our children as those same counties. And in fact, when you isolate our feeder patterns, like the Fletcher feeder pattern or the Mandarin feeder pattern, which serves children that are more likely to be at grade level, come to school with background knowledge, come to school with active parent involvement, those feeder patterns represent the performance of Nassau County, Clay County, and St. John's County. Our county is much larger. It's more diverse. It serves children, many more children in poverty, many more children in rural communities that are growing up in poverty. That's not an excuse. It's a reality. We're proud who we serve. Very proud of leading this county and the diversity that it provides. But diversity also leads to challenges, challenges that we're overcoming every day in our classroom. And I invite everyone to visit our schools, and you'll see the dynamic things that are happening, even with children in poverty. But we have to have a different conversation about performance where we're not just saying Duval County is here and St. John's is here, because I can simply just isolate our performance with Fletcher and Mandarin feeder pattern, but that's not the reality of who we are as a community and as a district.
Nico Lividi, always good to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, much more still ahead on the show later. A preview of tonight's art walk in downtown Jack's, figuring one big Oktoberfest bash. Also, the work of the Read It Forward Jack's Coalition, speaking of schools. But up next, the second annual See the Girls Summit. We'll tell you about it.
Education coverage on First Coast Connect is made possible in part by a grant from the Chartrand Foundation.
How do you turn a desert into farmland?
You bring in enough dollars and find enough water, and you'll grow the desert green until the dollars become scarce or the water runs out.
And when the water runs out in one desert, big agriculture moves into the next, half a world away. That's next time on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
The PBS Fall Arts Festival, airing Friday nights on WJCT, is celebrating its fifth season of bringing audiences the best in arts programming. This season includes Unity, the Latin tribute to Michael Jackson, and Danny Elfman's music from the films of Tim Burton. WJCT will host live performances from Atlantic Beach Experimental Theater and Players by the Sea on the main stage of Hemming Park during the third annual Oktoberfest Downtown Art Walk on Wednesday, October 7, beginning at 5 p.m.
Relax Radio is the great American songbook, oldies and light jazz.
It's the radio station I was always looking for and never found until now.
Harry Moonbeam's home in a jar.
Relax Radio is the station you can listen to all day on your HD radio. Make a $120 gift to WJCT and you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director and the star of the film Son of Saul. Set in the death camp Auschwitz in 1944, it's about the Sonderkommandos, the Jews who were forced by the Nazis to herd people into the gas chambers, remove the bodies, load them in the ovens, and dump the ashes. Son of Saul won the grand prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Well, this month, the Dolores Barweaver Policy Center will hold its second annual See the Girls Summit here in Jacksonville. The goal, to bring about reform of the state's juvenile justice system and some other changes to improve the way Florida treats its at-risk girls and young women. Here in studio, we welcome the center's president, LaWanda Rivora. Good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us by phone, Christy Daly, Florida's Secretary of Juvenile Justice. Secretary Daly, good to have you.
Thank you. Good morning.
And on the line, community leader and CEO of EHR Investments, Susan Remmer-Reisowick. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
Let's begin with you, LaWanda, how the summit came to be. This is an important community dialogue.
Absolutely. Well, the summit, this is our second year for having the summit, and it is about bringing together thought leaders from around the country, as well as our state and locally, to talk about how we as a community can ensure that all girls have the opportunity for a prosperous future.
Christy Daly, Secretary of Juvenile Justice in Florida, you've really worked to reform juvenile justice under Governor Scott. How do you see girl-centered reform being part of your administration, looking at girl-centered programming and the unique needs of girls in the criminal justice system?
Well, working with girls and having gender-specific programming for our young women is an integral part of our reform work. We know that girls are different, and the partnership with the Policy Center has really assisted the department in guiding us in implementing that gender-responsive, program level to meet the needs of our girls. And the work that the Policy Center does and the services they provide to their telemedicine, their telemental counseling and the Savvy Sisters group in our detention centers, and working with our young people that are transitioning back into their communities. I mean, it's an integral part of what we do, and the work that the Policy Center is doing is really changing the way we work with girls statewide, not only there at the First Coast.
Yeah, Susan, the Dolores Barweaver Policy Center is a national model for juvenile justice reform. Now, you're a powerful citizen advocate. You are investing in girls. Can you tell us a little bit about why you've gotten involved?
Well, my family, a number of years ago, established a foundation. And we have a strategic approach to our philanthropy, and we looked at sort of how we thought we could really make a difference. And this was back in 1992 when not much was being done about girls. And our belief is that if we could help, at-risk girls take better control over their lives and make better decisions, that would help to sort of end some of the cycle or break the feminization of the cycle of poverty. And that, girls are the mothers of the future. And if you invest in them and keep them in school and keep them from getting pregnant or getting into trouble, they'll be able to contribute to society and really make a difference for generations to come.
LaWanda,
on a personal level, I was an at-risk girl, and I know that the trajectory of my life was really saved and changed because there were people who invested in me.
Wow, I was not aware of that, Susan. That's really a powerful story to share at this summit. And by the way, it is coming up Friday, October 23rd at 4 o'clock at the Jesse Ball DuPont Center in downtown Jacksonville. Now, LaWanda, around the state, we've got a declining juvenile crime rate, but girls are the fastest growing segment in our juvenile justice system. They make up 33% of the juvenile justice population, but only 5% of the resources are going toward helping girls in the system.
Well, first, our summit is actually October 22nd through 23rd.
It's actually I got the date wrong. Yeah, sorry about that.
We got one day.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And, well, although juvenile crime is actually reducing for both boys and girls, it's the rate of reduction for girls is slower than for boys. And we... One of the reasons that we're having the summit is to bring attention to the specialized needs of girls and young women, and also to elevate the dialogue about the need for more resources, because we continue to be receive less resources than programs for boys.
Christy Daly is Secretary of Juvenile Justice. How do you see the state changing that dynamic?
Well, I think the work that we're doing in communities and really, you know, through all of our reform work of reducing the need for back-end services, and as we've been able to shift more dollars to prevention and diversion to local communities to strengthen that community-based service array, has been a big piece of what we have done. And we continue to strive to ensure that we've got the right level of services, you know, in all of our communities. And certainly working with the Policy Center and their level of advocacy in that community is tremendous. And I have known Dr. Revoir for a very long time, and the way, you know, she is able to bring people together to really talk about the issues, and her advocacy and her passion for these young women, and knowing that if we can reach them early, we have such a better chance of keeping them from ever coming into our system. And that's what we want. We want to prevent as many children, boys and girls, from coming into the delinquency system as a whole. And so, you know, as we work with each individual communities, we really do strive to assess what the needs are for services and do everything that we can to address those needs.
So it is the 2015 See the Girls Summit coming up at Thursday, October 22nd, and Friday, October 23rd, at the downtown Jesse Ball DuPont Center in downtown Jacksonville. Go to seethegirl.org for more. We're pleased to be joined by Christy Daly, Florida Secretary of Juvenile Justice, Policy Center President LaWanda Revoir, and on the line as well, Susan Rimmer Reisewick. Thank you all so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you. Yes, thank you.
And still to come, a preview of tonight's big Oktoberfest bash downtown. But up next, tackling the literacy crisis in this city. That's in a moment.
Follow what's happening at WJCT even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT FM at wjct.org/listen or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to bring me, Michael Feldman, and my show, What Do You Know, to the Florida Theater in Jacksonville on February 20th. We'll do the quiz, have some fun, enjoy the southern winter just a little bit. You bring the sunshine, I'll bring the sunscreen. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
Welcome back. Well, the First Coast Connect Book Club returns later this month with a discussion of writer David McCullough's biography of the Wright brothers. Check out a free copy of the book from the Jacksonville Public Library. They're our partner for the book club. You can also buy a copy at Chamberlain's or the Book Mine. They've got copies for us. And then we want you to send your thoughts about your first flight to bookclub at wjct.org. What do you remember about your first flight? Where did you go? What was it like? Was it good or bad? Send us your thoughts and we'll share them on the air. It's bookclub at wjct.org. Speaking of books and reading, around Florida, about 4 in 10 high school graduates cannot read at grade level. Here in Duval, it's closer to 5 in 10. That is a literacy crisis. Well, community leaders are really trying to do something about this, and they've started a new group, the Read It Forward Jax Coalition. Attorney and former school board member W.C. Gentry is leading the way on this effort, and he joins us now. W.C., thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And it's exciting. Read It Forward Jax Coalition is out with a new website. It's going public. Some of the top stakeholders in the community are behind this, but you've come up with this idea. You're the leader of this effort. What motivated you to put this group together?
Well, when I was on the school board, when I was chairman, we started the Read It Forward Jax program. And Superintendent Vitti asked me within the last year or so if we could revamp that. And what motivates it, quite simply, is that most of our children who are poorest readers are children from poverty. And we know that if a child cannot read proficiently by the end of third grade, if they're not on grade at third grade, that the prospect of failure is great. Some 70% of our children who cannot read at the end of third grade will end up in jail or on welfare. That's the national data. And we have here in this community a poverty rate of almost 40%, and over 50% of our children are in poverty. I grew up in pretty modest means over on Tallarin Avenue. In my home, I was fortunate to have parents who valued reading. And I learned to read by reading comic books and science fiction and anything I get my hands on. That skill has allowed me to be very successful. And I think we have an obligation to our children to give them that gift. And that's what Read It Forward Jax is all about. It's about reading it forward. And those of us who have the gift and have been blessed, we need to share that with our children.
The Read It Forward Jax Coalition is designed to get more books into the hands of more kids, make sure after-school programs, summer programs, have a literacy component, keep track of progress so that there are measurable results. In that sense, don't you want to model it after the Jacksonville Journey anti-crime initiative that was started a few years ago and that is coming back online?
Well, a lot of the model comes from Jack's Journey. In the sense that we pull together all community partners around literacy, something that's never happened before. We have a lot of organizations who are doing great work, but we tend to work separately, and no one organization has the capacity to really make an impact. What we're doing is bringing everyone together with the school district, to collaborate. And so through this coalition, we're already seeing a huge impact. We have, for the first time, an agreement to share data with the district. No one in the state does that from early learning through K-12, so we can really start assessing how our children are doing. We are working on the summer programs and after school. There are four major intersections. One is early learning, but it has to be aligned with the school district. And through our coalition, we've now brought the early learning community together with the school district to start building better alignment. After school, as you know, but after school in Duval, we're spending millions of dollars after school, but there's no literacy component. Mm-hmm. And so we're addressing that through the coalition. Summer school, the summer slide is probably the major cause of the disparity between those with wealth and poor children in terms of their progress in reading. That, and again, the summer programs, the city and other groups support summer programs, but there's not a literacy component. And also really, really important, access to books. Our poor children simply do not have access to books. And one of the things that we're doing and getting ready to go out in the community is ask our community members, our leading organizations, our civic clubs, to buy a reading library for a classroom where mm-hmm. the books are leveled so every child can read something they can read. Mm-hmm. The books are fun, and they can take them home. They can own them. And so we want to put a reading library in every classroom, and we want to support the library system and providing reading libraries there as well.
And as you said, make it fun for kids. They have to want to read.
they've got to be able to read it
because
it's no fun.
Yeah.
And we know choice is important. You know, who likes to read a book? Someone makes you read.
Uh-huh.
What you want to read is what you want to read. So we want to give them choice. And if they start loving reading, which is a key, if they start loving reading, then they'll read more and they'll become a proficient reader.
And you said as well, we have such high poverty in Duval County, and kids, by the time kids even hit kindergarten, so many are already behind. It's an uphill climb to try to get past that. But you feel that, and when you began this effort, you said, even knowing that, you feel that this county has to do all it can.
It is an uphill climb, but it can be done. And that's why I think I'm so passionate about it, because it's not excusable. I mean, every child in this community, by the time they leave third grade, ought to be reading. Every child can read, except those with the most profound disabilities. We have a good early learning coalition in this town. We probably lead the state, or one of the leaders in the state, in early learning. However, because of state prescriptions, the early learning program in literacy is not aligned with what they need in kindergarten. So we are going to supplement what the state does and help our early learning community get our kids ready. If kids come ready, then if we support them after school and in the summer school program, the schools are doing their job, but the community has got to step up to intersect in these other areas to help those children who come unprepared and who will slip back unless they have the help.
So you're going public now with a call to action, really, for the whole community to get involved. This is a privately funded volunteer effort. The website is live. It's rifjc.org, rifjc.org. You want business leaders, community leaders to join in this effort with their dollars and their savvy to join in this effort with you.
Absolutely. And Read It Forward Jax Coalition is a 501c3 nonprofit. And ultimately, I mentioned the four areas that we're really focusing, but this community has got to value reading. Reading has got to be important. And ultimately, we want this whole community to start focusing on reading. I'd like to hear people asking children in the grocery store when they see them, what are you reading? We need to make reading important because it is the key to success. It is the one thing we can address and solve and fix. And if we don't fix it, the poverty problem in this community is just going to continue to grow.
Lots of tweets. Nicole, what can I do to help Read It Forward, Jax? Here's a tweet from the GRASP Alliance. What is Read It Forward doing to help the 1 in 5 in town with dyslexia? A lot of interest coming in on social media. What about the dyslexia question?
That's a great question, and I think that I think there's data that shows that probably 25% to 30% of children that come into our schools have some sort of reading problem. And I know that Superintendent Vitti is very much focused on that. And a change, and there's a huge focus in our Duval schools now under this administration. We have to be able to identify children who have learning, reading problems early out. And then you help them build those compensatory mechanisms where they too can read. I mean, some of our most successful people in the world have reading problems, but they were problems that were addressed and they were able to compensate and become very effective readers. I know the superintendent understands that. He's made this a point. And so our job is to be present and to provide those support services that the district provides in that regard. But again, whether it's dyslexia or you're just a regular reader, you need to have access to books. And,
sure.
And so what we're doing supplements what the district is doing. And I think one reason why the community should feel really good about doing this at this stage is that we do have a school district that is doing the right things. They are doing their part, but we quite candidly simply can't get there without community support.
And people tweeting the show wanting to know how they can help, just go to the website. You can donate money. You can donate books. You can volunteer. Go to rifjc.org. That's the Read It Forward Jax Coalition. Founder W.C. Gentry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, finally, this hour, fall is in the air. Tonight's Downtown Art Walk will feature not just the art and the fun, but also the sights, sounds, and tastes of Oktoberfest. Kat Hardwick of Downtown Vision, Inc. is here now with a preview of all the fun. Hey, Kat. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
This is the third annual Oktoberfest at Art Walk. Very exciting.
Yes, we are thrilled. It's going to be the biggest Oktoberfest at Art Walk yet. We're doing a lot of additional programming this year. So start at Hemming Park. We're going to have Dan Wittecke and his Umpapa band. They have just come back from Munich, from Oktoberfest over in Germany. So we're excited to have them back this year. Lots of German beers, pumpkin cider. It's going to be really fun. And then going down Laura Street, we're going to have a Kinderfest zone. We're going to have a carnival zone, food truck village, and it's all going to end down at the Jacksonville Landing with another polka band. There's going to be a pumpkin patch, hay rolling contest, so much going on. And that's just 4 of the 15 blocks that are programmed out tonight.
Now, I understand Mayor Curry is going to do the official tapping of the keg ceremony. Is that right?
It is,
yeah.
In conjunction with Bold City. So that cask that's going to be brought out. It's going to be first come, first serve, free to the public. And then any of the stops along Laura Street, we're going to have all of that German beer. And if you bring your own Bierstein tonight, you're going to get a dollar off.
Former Jacksonville mascot Curtis Dvorak going to be on hand doing some fun stuff, too.
It's going to be a riot. We're going to have all kinds of contests. And then one thing that's very exciting as well, this Laura Street that we're activating tonight, we also have won an award just last week from the American Planning Association, naming that one of five of America's great streets. So we're going to have an award ceremony right before the tapping of the keg.
So exciting to see that Laura Street getting some well-deserved props from a national organization. Mm-hmm. It really has come alive in recent years. So this will be such a fun evening.
It's going to be the best time to check it out. And if you want to stay late, there's the first official Art Walk After Dark in conjunction with the Elbow. Everything's at iloveartwalk.com.
And you bribed me the other day with some pumpkin yogurt, pumpkin covered pretzels to soften me up to come talk about this. That was a very easy sell, Kat. They didn't last very long around this newsroom. Let me just say that.
Oh, good.
They were utterly delicious. So thank you for that. And come on out tonight for the third annual Oktoberfest at Downtown Art Walk. Lots of fun and Oktoberfest themed programming, beer, pretzels, music, and more. Mayor Curry will tap the keg at 6 o'clock along with Bold City Brewery. Kat Hardwick of Downtown Vision. Have a good time.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. Our show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a program. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, Russia is sending what it calls volunteer troops to Syria, and its airstrikes have targeted CIA-backed rebels. A look at Russia's support of the Assad regime and escalating concerns over a possible U.S.-Russia proxy war in Syria. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.